they say we should have known better than to fall so deep down into this rabbit hole.
Get
we found
ready. It's time again to venture down the rabbit hole into the world of cybersecurity. You're plugged into the podcast for security leaders and practitioners with a business sense. Prepare for unique interviews, insights, and practical advice that makes your job just a bit easier. And now, please welcome your guides on this adventure, James Jardine and the White Rabbit, Ruffalos.
All right, welcome to episode 318 of the Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. This is Raph, and got a timely episode for you today, folks. If you've been paying attention to Twitter, there's been some. I apparently started an accidental, storm of discussion on a topic that that I posted an article from. There, to give you guys a little bit of background, there is an article in the NLTimes.nl. The article headline is Netherlands in Cyber War, air quotes, with Russia, defense minister says. And so we started talking, and it just kind of got, it got very, very interesting. And so I had some folks that chimed in that had some real background, unlike myself. And so I figured, hey, let's get some intelligent folks that know what the hell they're talking about on this. And so let's go around the table here. Jonathan, we'll start with you. Some credentials and who you are, please.
Yes, hi, my name is Jonathan Nichols. My background is in psychological operations and cybersecurity. I'm currently a senior intelligence analyst at a defense contracting organization here in D.C. I deal these days with online propaganda, NATO policy, and NATO cyber policy.
And you are a returning guest.
Yes, sir. And this is the third episode.
Yeah, jeez. I have to send you a t-shirt. Hey, Patrick, speaking of returning guests, welcome back, man.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it. It's great to be back and talking to you about this. You may remember about a year ago, you were at a conference where I was giving a keynote, and we talked about in that keynote, Russia and what was going on in and around the space. So, I was quick to jump on board here. With this discussion, after guidance was sold to OpenText a year ago, I still stay pretty close to this particular topic. So glad to be back and can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, so very cool. So guys, the very simple fact here is that the defense minister of the Netherlands basically, and I'm going to onk, I, nope, not going to even try. I can't pronounce her name, not even going to try. Basically said, hey, the Netherlands is in the midst of a cyber war with Russia, and that there's a lot of that term drives a lot of people crazy. Let's start with that. Like, what the hell does that mean?
Oh, well, Ralph, give it to you. You never start with the easy questions.
Let's dive right in. There is no shallow end of this pool.
I'm wrestling with that. The idea that there's a cyber war going on, I think is a little difficult for me to stomach, in part because I think when people use the word war or when you think about war, that's not something that should be taken lightly. There's a lot of great Americans and people around the world that have lost their lives in wars. And I think there's a lot of gravity that comes with the idea that we're, quote, at war, whether in this case it's the Netherlands being at war with Russia. And I think we just have to be, like, super careful when we say that we understand what we're saying. And, maybe in this case, and I'll be interested to see where this conversation goes, I feel like perhaps that was maybe a bit too strongly stated, but perhaps that's just my view.
Well, so I mean, and we've all heard terms like Cyber Pearl Harbor and stuff like that. And Jonathan, I think you could probably address this from because you're probably the closest to it all around. Is this the correct term?
I would agree with Patrick. The term war is a little that carries strong implications, particularly in the NATO context. Does a NATO ally stating that they're at war imply that they're attempting to invoke Article 5, which is the article that states if you hit one of us, you hit all of us. In this case, probably not. It seems like she's using cyber war, and maybe this is a case of translation, but it seems like she's using cyber war in the more colloquial sense that you would see casually thrown around. At least that's certainly what I hope is going on. I don't want to get into a cyber war with Russia, but I do want to be cognizant, and I do think that she was attempting to raise the bar, and you see this a lot from our NATO allies, particularly from that part, the Baltic states, and the Netherlands area, where the NATO allies are much more quick than Americans or the UK to call out the Russians for their activities. And it's their argument is that's their way of inoculating their population against further follow-on attacks, whether it's propaganda or actual infrastructure damage.
So let me ask, because this anytime I attach the word war to something, whether and the term that popped into Twitter really quickly is Cold War. Was the Cold War a war? Or is this basically a standoff, right? You know, two enemies staring at each other across the line, see who would blink first. But there was a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, obviously spies and espionage and all sorts of good things, and you know, perhaps some tensions on the military side. Is this kind of like is this a similar term to Cold War?
I'm inclined to say yes. That's sort of the way it's being used in this instance. Patrick, would you chime in?
I think that's more right than it is wrong. I'm gonna try to play the side of this of, you know, people that bring attention to these kind of issues, generally I'm pretty supportive of. So I'm going to try to assume for a second that, you know, this lady was well-intentioned in drawing attention to the fact that, and I do believe this, Russia continues to modernize and digitize their longstanding practices and policies, both in terms of how they execute what they would refer to as compromise or like the use of compromising information. I think they've made it a very effective move in using that longstanding, like think back to the 50s technique in a more modern context. And I think that they've also taken a lot of longstanding, traditionally Russian military tactics and strategies, and they've digitized those too, and they're using today's technology to deploy, you know, tactics that they've been using for years. So to the extent that she's bringing attention to that, which I do think is happening, I'm supportive. Am I ready, you know, much like you, to say that's a war? No, I'm not ready to say that yet. That's, to me, that's a bridge too far.
Well,
the Russians have been go for it. The Russians have been known to be doing offensive online activities against particularly those North NATO allies for a considerable period of time, and in frequent discussions with those countries' leaderships here in D.C., you will see them get frustrated with us where we don't call it out, and this is a bipartisan thing. You're not doing enough to train our, in their eyes, they claim that we are not doing enough to train our populations to be ready to confront Russia, whether it's in terms of countering their propaganda or just educating the population on what that sort of looks like. Estonia particularly, and the Netherlands as well, are really frustrated with the US, NATO, or the US and the UK and a couple others, and are almost lackadaisical responses, whereas they will tell you that they state these things in such strong terms in order to inoculate their populations against this, to the point where I'm not a citizen of Netherlands or a citizen of Estonia, but they will state that their populations are inoculated against this such that when they see something that looks like it might be from Russia, they're automatically discounted as propaganda in a way that we clearly sometimes do not.
Yeah, I would say clearly is a good word there. Jonathan, something interesting then. This type of propaganda, I mean, isn't unique to Russia, right? The getting involved in all kinds of public life and policy, and trying to influence and perhaps cause digital and cyber mischief. I mean, the North Koreans are pretty famous. The Iranians are pretty famous for this. It's not, and the Chinese are pretty. I mean, it's not just the Russians, though.
No, certainly, but the Russians seem to be they're much more aggressive than our other adversaries have been at it. So yes, we have instances of Iran conducting offensive cyber operations. I think most famously would be their DDoS of the banks under the Izzeldin Al-Qassam cyber fighters back in, I think that was 2012. But they've also done IO campaigns at a much more grassroots level to disrupt and degrade trust in the US system, such as infiltrating the Black Lives Matter movement and Occupy Wall Street. Those are the things that we've seen Iranians doing. What we've seen Russians do is that, but to the next level. This gets into sort of statecrafting norms, and in cyber, we don't have these norms yet established. But we have established what counts as, you know, good or appropriate espionage acts between two states such as the US and Russia. But we don't have the same norms established in the global geopolitical community for what counts as an appropriate cyber action as it relates to espionage or, you know, countering other states' activities.
I think that point is actually super critical. One of the places, Raf, and you and I have spent some time talking about this, that's really kind of important to highlight, is there aren't these norms built around cyber. And I think in part that's because we still are working inside a system where there's just a lot more limited insight and knowledge from policymakers than is necessary for the level of sophistication of, you know, our adversary. And so absolutely, I think this is a really important point that's being made. John's exactly right. We have a long history and backlog of ways we've thought about, for instance, what classifies as war, what classifies as reasonable action, what doesn't. But when it comes to this particular niche, we have not done that, probably domestically, A, and B, certainly globally, we haven't reached some consensus on those standards. And that's a super important thing that needs to get done.
There are attempts being done on that. Just to piggyback on the point, the Talon Manual is a well-known, it's pretty much gospel for anybody in the NATO alliance. Any lawyer who deals with cyber has a well-eared copy of the Talon Manual sitting on their desks. And there's a new version that just came out a few months, maybe about a year ago, that was just more or less released, Talon being the capital of Estonia, which was hit significantly by a Russian attack, which disrupted their entire economy for a little bit of time. And so the Estonians were one of the first to really get on this. And their friends in the Baltic states and in the North Atlantic are very, very cognizant of it.
Guys,
and I think that this is related, is, you know, the danger of touching a third rail, which, you know, generally, Raf, you're not afraid to do. You know, I have wanted to see a higher level of technical acumen brought to, for instance, the Supreme Court here domestically, in part for some of these same reasons. I see it as a related matter. We need to increase the technical IQ of a lot of parts and pieces of our apparatus if we're ever going to get this right on a global stage.
Well, so it needs to be somewhat bipartisan. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. The bipartisan thing is good, so hit that.
Yeah, so it needs to be somewhat bipartisan. One of the issues that I've seen here just in D.C., where people that we know in cybersecurity have gone to work with the administration, oftentimes will simply just not admit it because they'll get browbeat by all of their friends. And I really find that sad, because even if you dislike Trump one way or the other, the need for the United States to have that technical acumen at the highest level is of critical importance to our entire national security. We can't go for 8 years not being engaged in those discussions or not having the best, brightest minds engaged on these, you know, interesting issues of cyber statescraft.
Yeah, and so look, but we've seen to kind of get further this point, we've been so far talking about information dissemination, deception, hijacking of, you know, certain movements with propaganda to basically steer them in a different direction or for whatever purposes that state wants to further. But we've actually seen on the other side of this, like there was a pipeline that went kaboom. Right, there was disruptions in, you know, I identify one that was, you know, where centrifuges were exploding. Like there's a lot of cyber operations that happened. Where do we classify those in terms of this whole cyber warfare? Because the U.S. is not innocent here.
Patrick, do you want to go first?
I was gonna say I can just hear both of you wanting to jump in on this one.
You know, I took the last hard one first, so how about you lead, I'll follow.
Okay. I guess I've never heard about this centrifuge explosion you're talking about. No, there's this happening. I think there's still an open question as like we said, we don't know quite yet what counts as an of war in cyberspace. There are attempts, as ham-fisted as they've been, to try to figure out what those will be. The centrifuge explosion, you know, was attempted to be non-attributed. I believe that it's been attributed in some autobiographies since. But we also have what appear to be these types of actions against, like, the New York State Dam and other such instances. It's not yet established jurisprudence or even regular policy to identify whether these things should be done. And it's actually an important point here. It's not yet even domestic jurisprudence as to whether this counts as an illegitimate espionage action from a state against another state or whether this is an act of war. And there's been some concerning elements along these lines. So, for instance, the U.S. indicting espionage actors from another state, whether it be Russia or China, I think both are out there. I think some Iranians are also on the wanted list. So they're indicting what would traditionally be legitimate, quote unquote, legitimate espionage actors from foreign adversarial states in the U.S. legal system. And there is some concern that that might not be the right way to go. What happens if we do it, then there's certainly room for China and Russia and Iran to then start indicting our espionage, what we would consider to be legitimate espionage actors operating against them. And if that happens, you know, say we have one of our own espionage actors operating in Iran or operating in Iraq, does that then give Iran the legal justification to kidnap those actors and take them for trial in their own country, much as we would if we saw a Russian cyber espionage actor hanging out in London? There's some serious legal questions around that, and there's some serious questions within the international policy community as to whether the U.S. attempts to indict people are the right way to go about this or not.
Well, and this is something like I think extensively there was a conversation a little while ago about maybe this is something that should be moved to the ICC, right, the International Criminal Court. Like, is this something that should be looked at from a UN perspective, maybe, and you know, whatever your feelings on the UN are, will influence how you answer that question. But there's got to be, you're right, the fact that, you know, the US indicting Chinese nationals and whatever seems like a great idea until you realize that they can, that means that gives them potentially the right to do the same. And that's terrifying.
You know, I think where this gets super murky fast is there's very little. We will run the risk of not consistently applying whatever standards we eventually get to. So I feel like in the short run, one of the bigger challenges is if you take an action because there are no standards, you're actually setting yourself up for kind of precedent. And in this particular case, I think that's a real challenge. Like, we need to find a way to be able to take action that we think will be defensible over some period of time while we sort out what the standards are. I think that this current state that we're in where, you know, oftentimes we don't prosecute in any way these things, that's not right. And then on the other end of the spectrum, I would argue when we do prosecute these things, more often than not, we're you know, pretty heavy-handed. You know, in this interim period where there are not standards, we probably need to find a more balanced way to take action on these things, you know, that we think is defensible over the long run. I would really like to see that happen, like, now.
And that's actually a huge additional point when it comes to U.S. and Russian and U.S. and China or U.S. and Iranian actions. It's really important that policymakers understand that we don't want to get, when it comes to term of, I'm a soldier. One of the things that we know in war is escalation of force So if you hit me with a, I hit you back with a slightly bigger weapon. That's sort of how that's supposed to go. That's a traditional war doctrine that I just very well dumbed down, and I'm sure someone's going to tear me apart with the actual manual quote. But we don't want to use the same escalation of force in war model when we're talking about cyber, particularly in this asymmetric world where we are very, very, very dependent on our cyber infrastructure, and they are not. So much like in the trade war with China, where China's run out of things to put taxes on our stuff, but we have plenty of Chinese goods that we can still levy taxes on. In the case of cyber, if we go tit for tat, we're going to run out of things to tat over there pretty quickly, and they're still going to have plenty of things for us to hit. There is a model of government responses called the DIME-PAMISI model. DIME, I think, if I remember correctly, stands for Diplomacy, Information, Military, and Economic. And so you don't need to use, you know, cyber attacks will say roughly fall into the I bit of that. We don't need, those are the levers of power that we can pull. Don't try to, don't reflexively hit cyber with cyber. You also have sanctions. You also have economics. You also have diplomatic pressure. And worst case, you have military action if that's what you need to go with. But having policymakers that can think in that nuanced way is really sort of where we want to be, and not reflexively hitting cyber with cyber, because we'll lose that fight real quick.
That's right. And I think, you know, on the flip side of that, we also do not want to give up the cyber domain, to use another kind of military-oriented term. We don't want to, like, universally give up our right to our cyber domain without planting some flags in and around it as important to us for all the reasons that were just outlined. It's critical to our infrastructure.
Well, and guys, taking this one step, you know, further, like, at some point, Jonathan, what you were saying is you escalate cyber actions into kinetic response, and that can get extremely dangerous extremely quickly.
Yeah, no, I'm certainly not advocating for that position. I'm saying that there are traditionally, as taught to grad students, you have to go on the policy. There's the DIME model to follow, and that one of those levers to pull is the military. I'm not suggesting that we do that. I'm just saying that there are other levers, and that policymakers need to think about that and not just think about hitting cyber with cyber.
I think that's right. I think what you're trying to say is there's already an existing framework for us to contemplate the reaction to these things. And rather than trying to invent something, perhaps we need to build in the thinking to use the existing framework so that the actions that we decide to take, where decide is an active word, those actions are, we feel, defensible and aligned with our existing practices and mindset. That makes perfect sense to me.
Well, so we get in the situation where, you know, we see enterprises looking at how they're going to defend themselves, and it's like, okay, are all of them going to be, you know, everybody looks at their threat models, and if they have one, and at the top of those there's, you know, hey, what if a nation state pursues me, right? And this gets into the, so if China attacks, say, Sony or, you know, Siemens or one of our big, you know, or our stock market or something, does the U.S. government then facilitate a response back, or is that a private response that they're expected to, and can they? I mean, those are some serious policy questions in there.
And, you know, just to highlight one aspect of that, that, you know, I continue to think we need to take action on immediately. And Ralph, you know this as well as anybody. These days, if you're running a global 2000 organization and what you just said happened, you know, you're most likely going to get whacked in the public markets and by the government for not taking the appropriate precautions. So there's really kind of a, in my mind, a perverse incentive here for you to kind of keep your hand down as a company when these kind of things are going on. And I think we need to invert that. It needs to be made very clear to organizations that if you're getting attacked by a nation state, it is okay to raise your hand and ask for help. And that, you know, the next action from, you know, the United States government isn't going to be to ship in, you know, the FTC or some other organization to give you a really hard time about the robustness of your operation. And if we want to make progress here, we have to make it okay for victims to talk about, you know, what's going on in and around their organizations.
I would agree. I think there's been a lot of work done. I'd say that was, I would have been in lockstep agreement with you maybe 10 years ago, but organizations like the FSISAC have made that level of transparency between organizations and with the government much more accessible. And it's not quite down market yet. So the Fortune 2000s maybe have access to it. You know, your small bank in West Virginia, close to my heart, would not have access to those types of resources. And maybe there was more that needs to be done there. But I think we're on the right track to solving the issue that you just highlighted.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we're on the right track. I think it's really important for us to understand that we have to prioritize these things. And, you know, prosecuting organizations, commercial organizations, you know, for their lack of robustness is maybe something we have to trade off if we want to make improvements in how we're resolving, you know, what could be national security issues. And I personally would prioritize resolving the national security issues the vast majority of the time over prosecuting some global 2000 organization.
Yeah. Hey, Jonathan.
There's also a place to be. Go ahead.
I was going to say, let me ask you this because I'm curious. This may be, you know, pulling this in a slightly different direction, but we've talked about the United States having the purview of critical infrastructure and how that's, you know, sort of a big deal, and we're going to protect that at all, you know, as a primary directive of our cyber policy. So say, you know, one of these dams gets attacked and essentially, you know, either taken over or causes some catastrophic issue, does our those are private entities, right, potentially, and does that mean that our government has an obligation to protect that or respond to that? Because I know if we would have, you know, done that to something like the Chinese or the Iranians, the government would respond. In the U.S., it seems like the companies are left to respond on their own. The U.S. doesn't seem to get that involved, doesn't feel it's their duty to protect.
And I'm not privy to the insides of the energy sector. From the people I've spoken to, so this is very anecdotally based, from the people I've spoken to who are in charge of, you know, organizing the energy sector, it's a little bit patchworky from what I'm being told right now. So some organizations work very closely with the government to make sure that they have the appropriate protections in place. Some are simply just looking to the government to make sure that they have they are following the appropriate policies, which is a whole different issue by itself. But it's a little bit patchwork, I think, is the short answer.
Yeah. So more concretely, though, so a couple of years ago, when the cyber fighters were, you know, DDoSing, you know, major U.S. banks, and there was a debate over, okay, is the banking system part of the critical infrastructure of the United States? And I think largely we said yeah, because without that, we have a major problem. So was it the government's then place to go step in and put blocks in or dedicate resources to stopping these DDoS attacks? And the CISOs I talked to in these banks at the time were like, we're getting no help. We're completely off on our own. We're not even getting intel. Like, what the intel they're getting was, they were getting it faster and broader from their private sources than they were from the government sector. So this kind of brings that full circle, right? If we're being attacked by a nation state in the cyber theater, the digital space, whose responsibility is it then to protect them? If it's the government.
So the problem with that intel question hits really close to home, particularly because I was one of those private sector sources at that time for the specific attack. So I guess that's a good mark for me, and I need to put that on my resume. Could you get a quote from me later? But the when it comes to government, published refined government intelligence is much different than, this is just the art of intelligence question. It's much different than the patchwork of single source, unvetted, random human intelligence source tells an intelligence analyst or tells a collector one thing. You don't want to be handing that out as refined intelligence to a public sector organization or to a private sector organization for a myriad of reasons. One, it's single source embedded; it might not be true. And you open the government a massive liability when that turns out not to be true. The people in those organizations are not likely well trained on how to use that data. You see that all the time when people get their hands on, say, documents from WikiLeaks and don't know how to read intelligence the way that it's designed to be read. So you see this with the ISACs a lot, or the FBI alerts that come out that are largely useless to anybody who's been in the space forever. The private sectors, the Fortune 2000s, do have their own internal sources who can speak that business and intelligence language and sort of merge the two and be useful for them. While it's largely the government that will give us the refined products and after that they've made sure that they've secured their sources and methods in a way that doesn't leave them open to liability or cause them to compromise their own sources.
Well, but beyond just providing
see that resolving anytime soon. Go ahead.
So, but beyond providing intelligence, I mean, actively deploying countermeasures and things like, infrastructure and security, countermeasures. So when the nation state attacks our critical infrastructure or our large companies or our companies here in the United States, I guess that's more of a policy question.
I think it's still an open question. I'm sorry, Patrick, you want to go?
I think it's just like, if you up level that, the thinking on that for a second, I this is where I am. I want to put my best people and my best resources on my biggest opportunities or my biggest challenges. And at this stage, and Raph, you made this one a little easier for me because you picked a very polar example, which was those CISOs saying they're getting zero help. Like, zero help is the wrong answer. I'm not positive I know how to make it perfect, but I think we need to do a better job than having no participation there, because for a couple of reasons. One, I do strongly feel that that compromising those kind of institutions has real economic impact on the country and to citizens, or at least could, and therefore we should take it seriously. A. And B, we should learn from those things so there's a feedback loop, so that we can contemplate what we want to do about it back to the framework of what action should we take if there's any. So the answer has to get to be better than zero. That said, you also know I would not support us kind of wholesale saying to commercial organizations, hey, that's the government's problem, so you don't have to worry about it. We need to find a better balance there.
A few of these points that we've brought up throughout the course of this conversation keep leading me back to cyber liability insurance, which is still in the private sector, well, in any sector, it's still in its infancy, and we still have a lot of questions as to even if the underwriters know how to do cyber liability properly. There's a lot of questions as to whether that market's going to mature at all. But I wonder if there would be, I don't know if it's been proposed, so I'm kind of spitballing here. I wonder if there would be an appetite for a cyber FDIC insurance of sorts, the same way that the banks are mandated to have FDIC insurance so that if your account gets wrecked for $10,000, we can recover that. I wonder if the same thing might be necessary in terms of cyber liability insurance, some sort of federally backed version of that, that would do more than zero, but still have a relatively hands-off approach in line with our economic policies in America.
That's interesting. I that's certainly I mean, it's certainly better than zero. But I think we can kind of, you know, as we kind of get up on time here, I don't want to run too long on the show because this is a pretty interesting topic, and I'm pretty sure we're not going to get to the bottom or jump to finish any conclusions here. But it seems like what we've discovered, you know, as we talk here is that it's definitely a big picture policy issue, and the one thing that we can all agree on is there really aren't any good answers.
No,
I would agree. Yeah.
If I were leaving this with one thought, what got me on this podcast with you today was in that article, the woman describes her ability to deploy our, so in this case, it's the Netherlands, our cyber soldiers. And the combination of the idea of a cyber soldier in war is where there are some red flags on this one for me. And you know, I think we're probably going to leave this podcast with more questions than answers, but I know that those two things didn't feel right to me.
I would agree. I would hesitate because there's a lot more interconnectedness in those smaller states that tend to be a little bit more socialist in their state government, their government to public sector, private sector interactions. So those guys may be using that term a little more loosely than we would here in America. I just thought that as a caution flag, as if this conversation didn't have enough already.
All right. Well, guys, thanks for the expertise and the discussion. I think this has been cool. I think this is something we want to revisit because there's a lot of nuance to this. And I think, again, the parting thoughts were spot on. Let's further the conversation. Let's keep it going. And if certainly hashtag DTSR, if you guys have listening, have a thought you want to add, some expertise you want to add, and that I'll post the link to that thread that we started because there were certainly a lot of real experts like you guys that chimed in and had some fantastic opinions. So always eager to get that. Jonathan, Patrick, thanks for joining. Folks, episode 318 of the Down to Security Rabbit Hole podcast addressing a slightly thorny topic of cyber war in the international theater as a policy and practice situation. So hopefully you got something out of this, and I'm sure you've got opinions on it. Hashtag DTSR, hit us up. And until then, we'll see you another time, another place, on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast. Ciao.
As we fade out on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole episode, we'd like to encourage you to chat with our hosts and guests using the Twitter hashtag #DTSR. Please check out the show notes, catch up on any episodes you may have missed, and subscribe so you don't miss a future episode. Our website is whiterabbit.net, whiterabbit.net. So on behalf of Rafal, James, for now it's goodbye. We'll see you soon on another Down the Security Rabbit Hole podcast.